So this is my first time speaking to a group of women this large for this long about this topic. And I just want to tell you, because I'm big into honesty and openness, I'm nervous. So you'll probably see me shaking a little bit. The minute I got Tyler's email, I started to get nervous. And then seeing my name in the bathroom in the church bulletin, I got nervous. And then last month, when Judy Rossi got up to speak, I got nervous, just thinking, like, that's gonna be me next month. So here I am. So as Tyler said, I started writing last year on a blog, and I'm just old enough to feel funny saying I have a blog. And through the internet and wonders of Facebook, Tyler found me. So she sent me this email, and to be honest with you, my immediate reaction was to say yes. My next reaction, once I actually sent the email, was to panic. Like, oh my gosh, what did I just do? What will I have to say? What will, I don't know. The whole thing was just like, what was she thinking? So, and then I thought, okay, the next thing I need to do if I'm going to speak at emails, obviously, is get my Bible and read it all and memorize it. And then I'm going to go to my bedside table and get like all the like books like this that like 15 deep and read all of them, especially the ones on fear, if this is the topic that I decided to pick. And then I should go to seminary, because I really did have all these thoughts, and I really did like look up some classes, and then I thought, okay, all right, relax. So I just went to God and said, it's just me. I don't know what to do. What am I going to say? I don't know what I have to say is important, and who really cares? And as it's been the answer to a lot of just even the reason of why I'm writing, it's just been, it's not about you. It's about me, God. And just tell your story. So that's what I'm going to do. So since honesty and openness are a big thing, I do want to tell you, we all know this. We all have a story. We all have something that we have been going through, will be going through, or this very night are going through, that's very hard. So although it doesn't need to be said, I think we understand this. I do want to say it. There's nothing spectacularly harder in my life than in yours. But I want to acknowledge and be respectful that many of you are carrying around profound burdens. Again, even very just tonight. And this is where I'd like us all to meet. So tonight I would like to share my story, but to give God the glory, who's able to change hearts and mold clay, and to encourage each of us to trust God to work in us, just where we are. So I'd like to just pray, if that's okay. Lord, thank you for loving us. Thank you for being a loving God and Savior. I ask you, Lord, that you will quiet our hearts and give us the ability to hear your voice. I do pray, Lord, that you will use me and that your name will be glorified. Amen. So I also wrote like tons of notes because I'm nervous that I'm just going to forget everything I have to say right in the middle of it. Okay, can I pull this closer? All right, we'll see if I can do all of this. Okay, so to tell you a little bit more about myself, I grew up in a Christian home. My mother immigrated from Eastern Europe when she was in her 20s and married my dad. I am the oldest of three. I also have three kids, so I'm like uniquely qualified to talk to people. I have a brother and a sister, like I said. They're all married and with kids and living in Ohio. You can see the cousin picture over there. That isn't even all of them. I'm the only one who moved away and stayed away. I got married at 20, and I've known Chris since I was in my teens. There we are. I think I was 17 at that point. So those of you with girls that are in their teens, like, I don't know if we have three kids. Oh, that's next. Okay. So I am a bona fide church girl. I grew up going to church. My parents went to church. Their parents went to church. And I gave my life to the Lord, recognizing that I was a sinner and I needed, the blood of Jesus, when I was 12, at a church camp. So I put these pictures of, this is my first PowerPoint, too, also, by the way. So So here we have Ocean. This is when you see an ocean, you're gonna be like, oh, now she's gonna talk. Okay, so that's your cue for the rest of this. Okay, so a long time ago, a friend of mine asked me, how do you see God? We were walking along the beach, and I kind of bumbled around because I thought, what in the world? Like, there's only one way to see God. And she said, no, really, like, just tell me, how do you see God? And so I used all these words that I grew up knowing and truly believing. He's omniscient. He's omnipotent. He's omnipresent. He's holy. He's untouchable. He's a righteous judge. He is scary, overwhelming. He's an all-consuming fire, and he's ready to cast anyone with an unconfessed sin or hardened heart into the lake of fire. And she just looked at me like, I mean, I probably didn't say it quite like that, but she just looked at me like, oh. I'm like, well, how do you see God? She's like, he's super loving and merciful and gracious and ready to forgive me for anything. And I was like, oh. So that's kind of this idea of God to me. And she went on to say how she, as she's matured, that she has realized that her loving God, there are consequences for sin and that there is holy living, and that she maybe needs to see a little bit of the side of God I knew. But then, of course, she said to me, maybe you need to see a little bit more of the loving side of God. So that's how I grew up understanding God. I knew he was loving, but there was also this very scary part to him. So my story tonight really starts in high school. When I was a senior in high school, right after the school year started, my parents took a vacation, and shortly after that, my mom just started to feel a little off. By December, she was sleeping a lot. She was complaining a lot of pain, and it got to the point that she was actually even going to counseling because the doctors told her that her pain was in her head. She continued to lose weight, take lots of Tylenol, sleep, all the while managing a household, or trying to, you know, a house, a part-time job, 3 kids, a husband, and, you know, we were all very involved with our school and our church. So there was this afternoon in March where she came home. I was a swimmer, so during this whole time, up until this point, I was up at 5:30 going to swim practice. I had a part-time job. I'd come home at 6 p.m. You know, I was around, but I guess that's high school. I don't know. And so even though all this was happening, I was a little bit detached from it. I was planning my life, right, getting ready to go to college. So it was one afternoon in March, and I was standing in our kitchen, and I had gotten home before her, and she came home from a doctor's appointment, came in through our kitchen, came up to me, grabbed my hand, put it on her stomach, and said, this. And she put it right here. And it was, she said it with this mix of like utter disbelief and complete outrage. She's like, this is what the doctor just, and she had an accent when she said, this is what the doctor finally felt today. If I can describe this, it was like the size of a grapefruit, but smushed right in the middle of her stomach and as hard as a baseball. The doctor had told her to immediately go home, get some things, and have someone drive her to the hospital. She stayed in the hospital for a week, getting some tests, and we knew by the end of the week cancer was a possibility. But that's all we knew. I was 18, my brother was 16, my sister was 11. So it was a Friday that she was gonna get the test results, and it was Thursday night that I told my dad I couldn't go to school. I couldn't go to school the next day, and he just said, okay. It's one of those things where you think, like, even at that age, you just knew, like, he's not putting up a fight. He's not, he's got bigger fish to fry. You know, this is not worth the battle. And so I remember picking out my clothes, a pair of blue jeans, a shirt I got for my birthday, and thinking, these are the clothes I'm going to be wearing when I find out my mother has cancer. Sure enough, I went to the hospital on my own the next day after they had already talked with the doctors. And I sat near the windows as my dad choked out the words, it's cancer. He went on to say she'll have chemo, but she won't lose her hair. It'll be mild, the mild form of chemo. I didn't realize at the time it was actually palliative chemo. So she started chemo. Part of her vocal cords were paralyzed, making all conversations quiet and somewhat strained. She continued to lose weight, and she was very confused because of the pain meds. And we didn't talk about the possibility of her death, because there was this really deep-rooted faith that she could be healed. And even though it all kind of seemed like it was going that way, we just didn't talk about it. And now whether that is because I think we all with kids, you only answer what they ask, that kind of mentality. Except at 18, I feel like I was pretty much almost an adult, but I didn't know what questions to ask, and still a kid, so not really knowing if I should ask. But it was May when I realized my mother's dying. And then it was Mother's Day when I knew it would be our last. So I am in Hallmark buying a card that I know will be the last thing I'm going to give, the last Mother's Day card I'll be giving my mom. Shortly after that, my guidance counselor called me into his office, handed me my cap and gown, handed me my diploma. He said, go home and try this on. Show your mom. Except I was like, I knew what he was saying, but, why? Does everyone get to do this? He said, no. You have to bring the diploma back, but you can keep the cap and gown to your graduation. So I went home and showed my mom. So I felt the weight of what was happening, even this, but I felt buoyed by the fact that we still weren't really talking about it. And I thought, well, maybe if no one's saying anything, I don't know. Not that I didn't think it was going to happen, but just maybe it wasn't actually happening, that God could still heal her. So it was during the last week of school, of my high school, that she went into the hospital again. And each of us were given a chance to talk with her alone. And again, without saying it, it was pretty clear this was our last chance to really talk. Knowing what I knew, yet unable to really say it, I knew I wanted to go and say I'm sorry. My parents were very strict, and I was not a bad kid, but I was a hard kid. I pushed a lot against their rules. So I had caused a lot of turmoil in my family as I was a teenager, and I hear this is very common with teenagers. Maybe I'm the only one. But I didn't want to go to my grave knowing that she went to hers without me saying, I'm sorry. So I started, and she just shook her head. And I started again, and she just shook her head and put her hand up and said, you're a teenager. You're a good girl. Which meant everything to me, and I still carry that with me. She knew my heart, even though I was tough. The week after that, she went into hospice, and it was during hospice, when she was still pretty coherent, that she had asked me when my graduation party was. This whole last month or so, she had been planning a graduation party for me. It wasn't elaborate, don't get the wrong idea. It was just something simple in our garage. And she said, when is it? I said, it's on Monday, it's 4 days away. And I watched her count. And then kind of fold her hands and nod her head and just go back to sleep. She was counting how many days she needed to stay alive. We all expected her to pass away that night, but she ended up dying on a Thursday. On Sunday, I graduated high school with all the smiles and pictures and friends. That's me and my best friend. That's me and Chris. 3 hours later, I took off my cap and gown that my mom only saw me wear in my living room, and I got ready to go to the funeral home for her viewing hours. Her funeral was the next day. So without question, this was the turning point of my life. This is the before and after that separated my childhood from my adulthood. This is what still defines who I am. I look back on it now, and I think pretty rationally, I could say that was hard, but I'm okay. But in truth, it was devastating. I was devastated. And there is a part of me that always will be. So I won't get into the slow, painful march of grief that followed her death, but I'm sure you can understand how it was emotionally, even physically, and especially spiritually crushing. So instead of going away to school, I lived at home and commuted to a local state school. And by the grace of God, my alternating sadness, numbness, anger, and apathy didn't get me into too much trouble. I literally saw my life with two roads. One that was just feeding into the hurt with like no clear destination, no clear purpose. And then the more practical, more traditional, but God-centered one that I knew I wanted to go on. That yes, I'm grieving, but I do eventually want to function as an adult, get my degree, get a job, maybe get married, maybe have kids, have a life, and learn to live with this. So Chris was around this entire time. We got engaged the next summer and married the summer after that. We lived in graduate housing. I moved up. He was in grad school. I moved up to Rochester in grad housing. We had two bills, rent and the phone. Our groceries topped out per month at way less than what I spend in a week now. We were very much living on love and his very small graduate student stipend. That's us in his lab. We moved to D.C. late in the summer of 2003 for a two-year position. Got that 13 years ago. We moved here for two-year position. Okay, just everyone to be clear on that. Okay. And so he couldn't start his job until he'd officially defended his thesis, do an oral defense, and that would be in October. So we moved here late in August. And I started to work in the city. I'm a nurse, and he wrote and studied. So as his defense approached, he started to get these headaches. He started to say that he couldn't remember anything. And because it was a stressful time, we just kind of took this in stride. So as this got to the point that we were going up to Rochester for his defense, pretty quickly when we got there, people talked with me, and they said, "What's wrong with him? He's a relatively quiet guy, but he's pretty funny in general. But he was so quiet, he had such a flat affect, and he was truly not himself that everyone else noticed." And it was the thesis defense when he had to get up and talk in front of his advisors, his colleagues, when we realized just how bad things had gotten. When someone asked him a question about his research that he had been doing for the last 6 years, he'd start to answer and then just stop. It's like he couldn't think through one thought to the next. So that night we went out to dinner and everyone just said, "Oh, he just needs to relax. He'll relax. It'll be fine. He needs to wind down." Except he didn't wind down. He started doing things like there's a whole list of things, but I'm just gonna give you two. It's upstate New York, middle of October, he walks out of the house without shoes. Like kind of like, I thought he was kidding, you know? He didn't realize he walked out of the house without shoes. Later that night, we were in the bathroom, I went to bed, I'm waiting for him to come to bed, and he just wasn't coming. And so eventually it was long enough where I went and looked for him. He was in the bathroom. We were staying with a friend and he was in the bathroom, just staring at the mirror, toothbrush in hand. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I don't know." So his parents lived about a little over an hour away. So we decided that we should go there and maybe it would make him feel more normal. But in between that decision happening and actually getting there, we knew we needed to take action. So his mom called the right people. We got there. He agreed to get help. He was very pleasant during all of this. He just was he was not initiating anything on his own, from emotions to speech. I've known him since I was 13 or 14, to be honest with you, and part of what has always been just part of his personality is just a confidence, a natural confidence. And so this was so beyond what I could ever imagine. I truly thought he had a nervous breakdown. He cracked. His thesis defense, and it just didn't make any sense. And I couldn't come to terms with it. So we took him to a psychiatric ED, emergency department, where I watched him take off his watch, his shoes, his belt, surrender them to security for safety reasons. After hours of interviews, they came back and said, "This doesn't fit any of our profiles. He needs to be medically evaluated." So he gets a CAT scan. And sure enough, he has a mass in his brain. And somehow, this makes me feel better. So after an MRI, we learned he had a massive bleed in his brain, which was depressing his ventricle and causing a midline shift. So for those of you who are in healthcare, you can look at this and say, this is very bad. For those of you not in healthcare, you can look at this and say, that is very bad. When there's a midline shift, the only place for the rest of your brain to go is down or out in some way. And that's called herniation, and that's brain death. So the bleed is in his left frontal cortex. This is where the language center is. This is why he could initiate a thought but not complete it. This is where the emotions are formed, so this is why he had such a flat affect. This is why he would smile when I smiled and cried when I cried. We celebrated his 28th birthday while he was in the hospital, and 3 days later he had brain surgery. Given that I'd taken care of patients with this exact same diagnosis, but from traumatic injury, I felt simultaneously relieved to be in my healthcare environment and know the numbers and know what they mean, and also terrified because of what I knew. I knew that he could come out of this surgery a completely different personality, and I knew that there's a continuum of recovery and that God could kind of put him wherever he wanted on it. I also knew that there are unknown an unknown number of possible complications, and I also was acutely aware of the fact that he may not come out at all. So this time, as they wheeled him to the OR, I said goodbye. But this time I knew full well what the weight of this goodbye could mean. I truly did not know if I would see that man again. Recovery was slow, but he did well. He started his job 3 months later. This is his post-MRI picture. So it's gone, but he has a little hardware in there. We kind of entered into this very blissful honeymoon phase of gratitude, kind of like after you have a baby or get married, everyone's real gentle with each other. We were so thankful for his health and his life. But after that, reality hit for him and for me. There are so many big and small reasons, but to sum it up like this, we were both so shell-shocked by what had happened, and it kind of happened all so fast and so suddenly that we were processing everything on our own. We retreated into ourselves and kind of by ourselves. In time, we sought out some counseling because we knew we needed to break down the walls that we had built between each other. And I still find it just strange how you can keep yourself so private from the person that you love the most. So we were both looking for God, asking for God to help, but heard nothing. We felt like we were in a spiritual wilderness. We were afraid to start living our lives. It was like we were waiting for the shoe to drop, you know, like didn't want to plan anything. But eventually we thought, okay, we need to start. And I'm talking, this is maybe a year or two, at least 2 years past this point of his surgery. So we planned a vacation. We got a dog. We had a kid and then another. But this spiritual wilderness feeling, wandering, just persisted, at least with me. But here's the truth. I was crying out to God from desperation, anger, and frustration, but I wasn't going to God to be still, to be comforted or to acknowledge my sin. I had gotten into such a bad habit of not reading my Bible. And by the time I had two little kids, I had convinced myself that I was too busy. And I didn't even really know how to start again. I was depleted pretty much of every reserve I had. And I think I could probably talk for another 40 minutes about what not having spiritual connections or spiritual accountability can do to a person and then do to a marriage. But for the sake of time, we all understand that it's not good. So a friend of mine invited me to go to a Bible study. We learned about John, and this is where we learn about God's love and abiding with him. And there were women scribbling notes, just notes after notes while the woman spoke. And I just sat there and tried not to cry. First of all, someone was taking care of my kids, which any of you in childcare, just thank you. Because sometimes mothers just need to be fed. So I just sat there trying not to cry. And I felt like it was like a hot shower or a bath, you know, where you just let it run over you, envelop you, saturate you. And then after John, we studied Isaiah, God's love of his people, his redemption of them, and how he upholds them. And so it was after this time of rest and healing that we started to study Acts, where the people of the early church were transformed by the power of the Holy Spirit. The apostles performed miracles, and regardless of who they were beforehand or what they did beforehand, the spirits changed their lives. And I knew all of this. These are books that I had read since I was really young, but to sit and really in-depth study them was powerful. And so it was during this time, after I had some time of, okay, I can take a deep breath, I couldn't help but ask, if God is three in one and God is unchanging, then the Spirit in Acts, shouldn't this be the same, isn't it the same Spirit in me? And shouldn't my life, and I'd like to ask, shouldn't your lives be marked with the same kind of transformation and power given by God? So it was around this time that I asked this question, that I told a friend that I hadn't seen for a while about some of these thoughts about transformation, and we were reading the letters, and we were reading Romans, but I'm a church girl, and how does that look to be transformed when you've always been pretty good? And she handed me a book, and she gave me a little note, which she had written before she saw me. And part of it just said, hoping this year brings forth great fruit and transformation as you rest in Jesus and enjoy him. And I just think it's neat how the little notes like this to our friends can mean so much that years later they hold on to it. So those of you who are note writers, keep doing it. So shortly after this book, there was a raffle at Imams. Do any of you remember this? Like back in the back, there's a bunch of parenting books. We got some raffle tickets and we got to like throw ours in. So I put all my tickets in for the parenting books that I wanted. And there's this one book that had this really funny cover. It was like a lady that was either like screaming or like vomiting or crying into her purse. And on the back, I read it and it was like, for women who have trouble managing their raw emotions, it was like, ding, ding, ding. So I tossed one single ticket in there in the bucket and thought, if I win this, there's no denying that God wants me to read it. So guess what? I won it. Put it on my pile, my bedside table pile, and let it be there for, you know, a few months. Even though God gave me this book, essentially, like handed it to me, I still kind of waited. So anyway, I finally read it, and I was breezing through it. It's an easy read. It's a good read, I'd suggest it. And doesn't it figure, like, right towards the end, there's just this one section that stopped me in my tracks. I gave the book away, so I wasn't able to get the exact quote, but I did write down, essentially, this question she asks: have we become so comfortable with our Christian, suburban, womanhood lives that we don't even expect, anticipate, or even ask God to do the miraculous through us? Emphatically, my answer was yes. So not only did I not expect him to do anything miraculous with me, I actually wasn't sure I wanted him to do anything miraculous with me, like even remotely. I really realized I was so afraid of asking for anything because we were finally at a point where we were kind of sailing smoothly. I did not want to rock the boat. So I'm not a worrier by nature, you know, so I never thought of myself as fearful. But this is when I realized how fear had really deeply rooted itself in my life. I had allowed my fear truly of, I think at its core, of God himself, my understanding and of what he could do with me, to justify any and all inaction. I kind of felt like, or even thinking about it now, like the servant who buried the money, you know, just you were afraid of what the owner was going to say, so you just didn't do anything because it's better than losing it, I guess. I don't know. I was so afraid of being vulnerable. I wasn't willing to say, I'm yours, God, because I knew God can do whatever he wants with us, right? And I knew saying, God, you can do whatever you want with me, I couldn't say that because I knew that what God could do was terrifying and horrible and hard. And so I held God at arm's length. And in this book that my friend had given me before is this quote. I'll read it from the book, but it's up on the... Perhaps the opposite of faith is not doubt. Perhaps the opposite of faith is fear. To lack faith perhaps isn't as much as an intellectual disbelief in the existence of God as fear and distrust that there is a good God. If I don't emotionally believe, practically believe, in the goodness of God, am I a believer? Don't the believers have to believe? Don't the saved have to trust the Savior? For yes, salvation from sins, but this too, the salvation from fear. So it was during those years of studying the Word and learning God's character that I really understood and finally understood. It's hard, though, that I can say, yes, Lord, I'm yours because I know you are loving. You are good. You are for me, and you've redeemed me. And this is a different view of God than I had when I was younger. And that's powerful. So if you were here in January, you heard Laura Frey talk about the Significant Woman class, and I had taken this class right around the time that this just was, it was just a perfect timing for me because I started to understand that God made me just the way he wanted me. I didn't have to fight to be the quiet wallflower that I thought I needed to be. He let me go through what I've been through for a reason, and that he had work for me to do. This was the first time that I thought that maybe this desire to write that I had been writing in journals for the last 20 years, I'd like to write, I think I should write, it'd be nice to write, that it maybe it wasn't so much about me and maybe it was actually something that God put in my heart. So when kids, our kids don't do something, when my kids don't do something that I ask them to do or tell them to do, at its core, I call it disobedience. And so again, I couldn't help but ask, is not doing what God has put in your heart to do actually just disobedience? So I'd like all of us to take out the note cards that are in your little cubby thingy and grab a pen. Please, no one panic. I am not going to collect these. I'm not even going to ask that you share them. You can write in code or another language. You can draw a picture. This is just for you, but please, please, please write something down. I think it's powerful when we write something down. John Piper said, "The eyes of God are in pen and paper." So, quietly to yourself, please be totally honest. I'd like to ask, do you have a burden on your heart of something that you really want to do? Is there something that keeps coming up, some direction to move, or something to pursue? This will be the thing, potentially, that has consequences you can't predict, that requires effort that you just don't think you have. It's the thing that may not make sense in light of your finances, experience, current skills, or season in life. This isn't something to do for God to be, for Him to look on you better. This is just an acknowledgement that God does not want us to just be hearers of the word, but doers. He wants to save us, but then He also wants us to live out our great commission in the unique way that we're equipped to do that. And we are supposed to take steps in faith and obedience. So my guess is that for some of you, something pops into your head right away. You're scared to death, maybe. You haven't done anything yet, but you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think there are some of you who probably know what God has gifted you and wants you to do and has purpose for you, and you're doing it. And I think that that's amazing, and I'd like you all to share that with us through personal conversation. I think it's possible that there are some of you who have, this is the first time you've asked this question of yourself and of God. And I think there's probably some of you who are actually afraid to ask this question. It's too big, and it's too much, and you're too scared. And you're also holding God at the arm's length. I wonder, too, if this might be just a time for some of you to just, it's a reminder for simply contentment where you are. Or it could be a time to confess sin, or a time to simply accept a time of rest and healing. So the question really is, Lord, how do you want me to be obedient to you? So if someone asked me this question a year and a half ago, my answer would have been to write and to adopt. But both of those things seemed so out there. And I could never imagine how either one of them could happen. I recently found in a journal, going through some old things when I was, I think it was from when I was 19. So it was a year after my mom died, that I wrote, I want to write. I want there to be purpose in this. I want there to be purpose from the pain. And adoption has grown from a very small seed in my heart to something that's blooming. So here I am. I feel broken, but made whole, empty, but full, tender and vulnerable, but strong. I am both sad and spilling over with joy. And this is how I can say that I am full of fears, and I can admit my fear, but yet also move forward in faith. So I did not start writing and immediately like get a book deal or, you know, volunteer to speak at EMOMS, or even expect that someone would find me immediately and say, come speak. I just took one step in the direction I knew God was leading me in, just one step at a time. And I still don't know what the end point is for writing or for the adoption, but I'm moving one step at a time in faith. We are, Chris and I. And it was as if, and continually just going back to the Lord saying, I don't know what to do, and I'm scared, and okay. And it was as if He was saying, trust me with your writing and see what I'm doing with it. And because of that, trust me with this adoption and see what I will do with that. So I just think for all of us too, I had shared at my table that I was worried this was just fear, faith, and obedience, that it was just something that I struggle with. So I just wonder what would happen if we saw our fear for what it is, if we confess it. And I just want to encourage us to understand that God does have plans for us, and we need to move forward in faith in steps of obedience and allow Him to work with us for His glory. Thank you.